ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
How did life on Earth begin? DNA, RNA, or a combination of both? Hello, I'm Eric Anderson, and on this episode of ID, the Future, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Cornelius Hunter to discuss recent research and the ever-changing ideas proposed for a naturalistic origin of life. Dr. Hunter is a well-known figure in the debate over evolution and intelligent design and probably needs no introduction. But for listeners who may be new to our program, Dr. Hunter is a fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture and an adjunct professor at Biola University. He received his PhD in biophysics and computational biology from the University of Illinois and is author of the books Darwin's God, Darwin's Proof, and Science's Blind Spot. Welcome, Cornelius.
Good morning, Eric. Nice to be here with you.
So it's great to have you with us today on the show to talk about one of the most interesting subjects of all, and one of my favorites, the origin of life. I've spent a fair amount of time researching these issues and have done some writing on this topic as well. So what I thought we'd do today, rather than a formal interview, is just more of an informal conversation together, maybe brainstorming a bit on these issues.
That sounds like great fun.
So you recently authored a blog post, which was picked up by Evolution News, about a brand new paper that noted another challenge to the RNA world hypothesis. Before we get into that, let's back up for a minute and set the stage for what we're talking about. Many of our listeners will have some familiarity with this, but just briefly, what is the RNA world hypothesis?
Well, Eric, maybe we should back up one more step, and that is, without the RNA world hypothesis, what are we looking at for origins of life? So the way cells work today is they store information in the DNA, but then you need an army of proteins to access that information, transcribe the data to make a copy, and then other proteins to edit that, and then other proteins and molecules to convert it or translate it to proteins, and so forth. It goes on and on. Mm-hmm. That sort of a system to set that up and get that up and running in an origins of life scenario is very daunting. So the RNA world was an attractive alternative for evolutionists, where you store the information and you also have an enzyme, or that is a molecule that can do things all packaged in one. So instead of having to have the DNA and then have proteins act on the DNA, you've got RNA. RNA has that interesting capacity to both store information and perform as an enzyme. Hence the RNA world hypothesis. Maybe the first life arose in an RNA world. Then it developed, evolved, built. You built up species at a very crude level. And then somewhere along the line, you have to transform to the world that we know and love today, where the DNA is storing the information. So that's the idea that came along several decades ago, back in the late 20th century. And it has stuck, so to speak. It's been very popular amongst evolutionists, although it has a whole litany of problems.
Yeah, so that's a great summary for our listeners. Maybe we could back up even just a little bit more. There's some really fascinating history behind all of this that we could probably spend a couple of full podcasts on. But just briefly, there was a lot of excellent research going on even back in the late 1600s by the Englishman Robert Hooke and later the Dutch scientist Antony van Leeuwenhoek, who was a great leader in microscopy, but also considered by many to be the father of microbiology and one of the greatest observational scientists of his era. So there's a lot of interest in origin of life ages ago. We sometimes think it's a recent interest, but for present purposes, we can fast forward maybe to the late 1800s when microbiologists finally had microscopes sensitive enough to start peering into the cell and realizing that the cell was not just a simple blob of protoplasm, as the term had been used, but in fact had some discrete internal structures and internal organization. And then you kind of turn after the century, we have the great Soviet biochemist Alexander Oparin and J.B.S. Haldane, who proposed a kind of chemical evolution, they called it, to kickstart the origin of life. I think it was Haldane that talked about the oceans on the primordial Earth being a hot dilute soup, he called them. So we kind of get this idea of a primordial soup. So why did they begin talking about the origin of life at the chemical level rather than the cellular level?
Yeah, and by the way, you can trace that soup idea back to Darwin himself and his letter to Oparin, right? Oh, what a great thing it would be. a warm little pond.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so one of the key moves that Darwin made was natural selection. It was kind of in between the lines or implicit in Epicureanism from 2,000 years ago, but never really brought out. And the magic that Darwin brought was, aha, this is the way the world arose, the biological world and all of its complexities and all of its wonder arose by natural selection. As long as you have an up and running world that has inheritance and species and variation, then the better ones have greater productivity and their traits are passed on, inherited to their progeny. So all was well in the world of evolution. You could spin stories around natural selection, but what about first life? You don't have natural selection up and running yet. You don't have populations, organisms, inheritance, variation, and all this going on. You've got an inert, dead, inorganic world to work with. And that's the problem of chemical evolution. You need to somehow get that first population up and running so you can then start playing around with natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
So chemical evolution.
Yeah, and partly driven also in that time frame of the idea that, well, the recognition, I should say, that getting a complete cell up and running by chance is not going to happen. And so you push it back and back and say, what's the simplest thing that we could get going on the early Earth? And one of the things that I've pointed out previously, and even a lot of critics of abiogenesis and a lot of ID proponents don't quite understand this point, but it's very clear from current origin of life research today that they are absolutely depending upon natural selection to build the first living organism. So this bright line that people sometimes think between origin of life and evolution afterwards is really not the case anymore. What they're hoping to get is some simple self-replicator, hopefully even a self-replicating molecule that they think will constitute the first replicating system. And then, as you say, natural selection, the magic of natural selection can kick in and build all the things that you need for a living cell, you know, functional DNA, metabolism, a functioning membrane, all of these kinds of things will come out of this idea of a self-replicating molecule. And so the RNA world says, hey, if we can just get a simple self-replicating molecule up and running, then, you know, we're good to go. Natural selection kicks in and Darwin builds the first living organism for us.
You know, Eric, I want to build on that point you made just a little bit about the bright line no longer exists. And I think that's a good point that because it is such a powerful explanand, if you can have natural selection up and running, it serves your purposes for storytelling so well that evolutionists have pushed it back and not wanted to limit themselves. I just did a blog recently on the great physicist Brian Greene, professor at Columbia. Of course, he's not into the biological side of evolution so much, but he's very much into the cosmological physics, how did the universe evolve sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was full on with that. Natural selection operating in the chemical world, in the inorganic chemistry world, was up and running full speed ever since the Big Bang. And he described how these chemicals work exactly the way that evolutionists speak about populations working. So you're absolutely correct that I don't think it's legitimate. I don't think the erasing of this bright red line was legitimate, but it was kind of a needed move.
Well, it's a great story, and it also allows you to say, hey, we don't have to get a living organism up and running. We could get something much, much simpler, hopefully. But there have been a lot of problems with that and getting that up and running.
Exactly. And a fundamental problem that I think we should probably emphasize here is just the simplest organism that you can imagine, at least according to today's biology, is incredibly complex. So there's this enormous gap between the inorganic, non-living world and the simplest initial biological world you can imagine. And that's the problem, the fundamental problem of origin of life studies. And I like that history you laid out a minute ago. It wasn't so much of a problem for them, I'll say, you know, Oparin and beforehand and back to Darwin, because they didn't understand the complexity of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, it didn't seem so daunting. It was, as you mentioned, a blob with a bag of chemicals that did some things. And biology was complex by virtue of quantities more than quality. It wasn't that basic cell was just so complex, but rather you just had millions and millions of them working together. So you built up your complexity that way. And back in 1924, Oparin made this famous prediction that the origin of life research would be solved, quote, very, very soon. and that really turned out to be a wrong assumption, a wrong prediction. But that confidence did hold throughout the 20th century. You had really over the top and just silly statements, even up to the end of the century, by the National Academy of Sciences and scientists in general, as well as science writers such as Carl Zimmer, making these sorts of over the top statements of, you know, it's basically a solved problem. We're just filling in the details, the details left up to the student. And in fact, they were nowhere close to that.
Yeah.
We should probably also note that it has changed, and for the better. So in the last, say, 20 years or so, there's been some refreshing honesty. And that has been forced onto the scene by the facts of the science. It's just been undeniable. And the failures have been so clear and so obvious that it just couldn't be held back. And so you do now have, in the past, you know, few decades, admissions, and more recently, that, we're nowhere close. Some evolutionists have been saying, we're never going to solve this problem.
Yeah, that's a good admission. I'm thinking of Shostak at Harvard, who said maybe we're halfway there, which is not quite the same as Oparin saying we're just about there. But so in 1924, okay, so we're coming up on the 100-year anniversary of that prediction. Pretty soon here. So yeah, the problems with the RNA world hypothesis, which was kind of a, as you say, a two for one, right? Because it was noted that RNA had the ability to act as an enzyme, act as a catalyst, as well as store information. So we could get past this chicken and egg problem, it was thought, where we have the information storage, but then we also have to have molecules that are doing something in the cell. But we've run into some problems with the RNA world hypothesis, despite the numerous researchers and the millions of dollars poured into this over the last few decades. First of all, there's been no luck in building a realistic RNA-based precursor. There's been a tremendous amount of effort to build a self-replicating RNA molecule without success. And you sometimes hear headlines about, you know, self-replicating molecules, but when you dig into the details, you find that that's not really what they've produced. And then there's also a lack of a plausible scenario to produce DNA from RNA under realistic prebiotic conditions, and to do this transformation from the supposed RNA world to what we see today, where we have DNA as the primary storage molecule and RNA as well.
There's no getting around it. You know, Charles Carter recently wrote in a review, such a rise from RNA to cell-based life, that is our DNA scenario today, would have required an out-of-the-blue appearance of amino acid tRNA synthetase-like proteins that work even better than its adapted RNA counterpart. That extremely unlikely event would have needed to happen not just once, but multiple times. So it's worth pointing out these very special proteins that he's talking about, amino acid tRNA synthetases. These are the kind of the key implementers of the DNA code. And what they do is they attach a amino acid to a tRNA molecule that will then get used when you translate to create a protein. The tRNA loses its amino acid in the process as it's used to build proteins, but that tRNA coded for a codon that was matched up with the codons in the copy that came from DNA. A long, complicated story, but that's the way it is. And so the tRNA is then spent or uncharged, and it has to be recharged again. And that will happen, again, with these special proteins. There's just no getting around this. One way or another, whether you delay it and push it out with this RNA world, it's going to happen at one point. You're going to have to build up this complexity. And it's just not obvious at all how this possibly could happen. Even if you do push it out with the RNA world, you're going to have to stand this up at some point. And so he ends up with his quote. He says, it just doesn't make sense. So this, yeah, you're right to point out this transition from the RNA to the DNA world. We don't have a good model for how that could possibly occur. That's one of about, roughly 10 or a dozen problems with the RNA world.
And what you're saying reminds me that Crick, even though he was certainly hopeful of a naturalistic origin scenario, once he realized that he was dealing with the coded system, he came up with a very thoughtful hypothesis about the need for these molecules that help translate the symbolic language, if you will, of DNA into the physical chemical language of the amino acids and the proteins, and was absolutely spot on for the need for this translating system.
Yeah, that's the basic core, well, one of many, many problems for origin of life. You know, these things just don't operate in a vacuum. So standing up this core problem that you just mentioned Crick envisioned is core, but we also shouldn't forget that it has to operate within an environment, you know, within a context. You have to have supporting systems all around. So it's another enormous problem for the origin of life. We so often see great confidence attached to some finding. The Uri Miller famous experiment that we all read about and heard about in biology class back in high school was so well advertised and well accepted, yet all it was doing was synthesizing a few amino acids. Mm-hmm. You have a long way to go between that and standing up first life.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of an analog to that in what we're seeing today. Starting a few years ago, I would say, there's been a push to say, well, the RNA world isn't quite working for us. We haven't been able to get things up and running. We have this transitional problem anyway. So maybe life actually started with both RNA and DNA at the same time, which makes sense, of course, because that's the way life works. But it does raise the question about how you get those up and running. And so there have been a couple of recent papers, one that you blogged about, which came from, let's see, December 2020. It's got a challenging title, but one of the Science Daily news releases said, "Discovery boosts theory that life on Earth arose from RNA-DNA mix." And then last June, there was an article that I blogged about as well that, again, in New Scientist, it said, first life on Earth may actually have been built from both RNA and DNA. So the effort to have RNA and DNA together makes some sense because, as the authors say in the article, it streamlines the eventual genetic takeover of homogeneous DNA from RNA as the principal information storage molecule, which is a mouthful, but basically it's just saying, look, if we start with both of them, then we don't have to do this transition, right?
Right. So you went to the RNA world in order to solve this problem of standing up this very complicated world, and you realized, well, at some point you have to do it anyway. So, and by the way, the RNA world has a dozen or so major problems. So let's find something else here and back off. Let's walk this back a little bit. Aha, maybe there's this magic happy medium where we're using the RNA, but we team it up with DNA such that that transition, that back transition, won't be so daunting after all. But I think it's worth looking at the history and philosophy of this whole field of study because it teaches us something about how science works and how errors can propagate for so long. When you have a study like this coming out, or a new move coming out, as you mentioned, several papers have come out with this new move of this hybrid RNA-DNA world, it then becomes permissible to admit to the problems that have been around. Now, these have been lurking in the background, but now as this new paper you mentioned came out in December, it was then permissible to start to admit to some of these problems. And one of them is that RNA is too sticky. It sticks to itself. And that's one of its jobs. It closes a loop on itself, forms hairpin turns, and sticks to itself and so forth. And that's a problem right there. RNA is too sticky. And so the RNA world really doesn't work, is what they admitted. Well, that's been known for a long time. This isn't a new finding. And so for me, an interesting part of this is, out with the old, in with the new. Oh, yes, well, that one didn't work anyway. Well, why was it in textbooks, and why does it continue to be in textbooks and journal papers, if that's the case?
Right. So just to be clear for our listeners, you're not arguing against the chemistry that is shown in the paper or necessarily the findings that they're showing. But what you're pointing out is that, you know, they're acknowledging at this point there's an issue with the RNA-only approach and kind of walking back and saying, hey, we need to have both of these together, or at least this is our next idea, is that maybe we can walk this back a little bit, have a little more complexity at the beginning so that we can avoid having to get the complexity later.
Yes, that's right, Eric. However, there is a higher criticism of this new work that I think is important. This is where it really is helpful to have some history and philosophy on your side. I'll start by saying, if you'll just look at the RNA world hypothesis itself that we've been talking about, focus in on the last 40 or 50 years, it is a real roller coaster. And it's really kind of humorous to watch that and track that over those years as it has gone up and down over and over again with proclamations of, aha, we've got it solved, and very bold. And to the uneducated or to the lay audience, it's going to be impressive. It's going to be daunting for anyone who just wonders, gee, is this really possible? Oh, well, gee, they've solved it. Look at the confidence that they have, only to be followed 6 months later or a year later by an admission that, well, actually, there's a big problem here. And so the RNA world has just a very interesting roller coaster going on. And if you really know the science behind it, you're never really that influenced by those peak moments, because you know there's all kinds of problems here. And the stickiness problem is one of several. RNA enzymes don't function very well over a wide range of temperatures. They tend to degrade RNA. You have an enormous amount of information you're going to have to generate one way or another at some point. There's a big problem there, just generating the information. There's no evidence of an RNA world. I think you touched on this a minute ago, but if this was true, you had to have this RNA world up and running and then switch over to a DNA world, the world we know today, without leaving a trace. There was ever any RNA world. There's no RNA world organisms left over. Nothing for us to look at and point to and say, aha, gee, here we have evidence that this world existed. That would be much more persuasive and certainly expected. We would not expect this world simply to go away altogether. And even if it did, at least there would be a theoretical basis we could look at and say, yeah, well, we can't find any of these organisms, but we can construct some. That hasn't happened. There's been no demonstration. I think you mentioned that as well. Then you've got this problem of switching over to the DNA world. All kinds of problems with this world, even though it has been advertised as the savior of origin of life for so many years now.
And just to put a blunt point on it, this idea of a simple self-replicating molecule, typically envisioned as an RNA polymer, this RNA world idea has not been demonstrated. It has not been observed. It has not been created in the lab. It seems the only place it exists is in the minds of abiogenesis researchers.
And so once you understand that history and that roller coaster and how these over-the-top positive claims are permissible, I mean, if they're unjustified, that puts it in context when you get these new papers coming out on this hybrid DNA-RNA world. Gives you a little bit more of a realism to look at it. Now, one problem I can see with it right off the bat is not so much the basic chemistry, although there are problems there, but it's the complexity of the theory. And that is something you see in evolutionary theory. Ever since the Epicureans, the move to more and more complexity in your theorizing, which is a major violation of Occam's razor, the fundamental rule of science. You don't want to end up with theories that say on Tuesday afternoon it works like this. It has to be a general, basic, fundamental theory. If you look at all the famous theories that we all know and love, classical physics, Newtonian physics, Einstein's relativity, thermodynamics, electrostatics, electromagnetics, they're all based on basic, fundamental laws you can say in one line. You know, F equals MA, entropy increases, equals MC squared. And when you get into these very complicated theories, that's what Occam warned about. You're going down the wrong path. Well, evolution, you know, when Darwin started out, you can argue he had at least a reasonably simple starting point. Okay, you have variation in populations and you have natural selection working on that variation. Everything mm-hmm. else falls from there. And that's, of course, what Darwin was striving for. He wanted to be the Newton of biology. But ever since 1859, actually even before, when he was developing his theory and working it up, he ended up with a very thick book. And ever since then, it's gotten only worse. And evolutionary theory is worse than the tax code. It's incredibly complicated theory with special cases all over the place. And we're seeing that before our eyes with this origin of life. There are so many different hypotheses that have been played with and discarded. This DNA, RNA is, I think you've looked at this more than I are. It's a very complicated setup that you need to get this going.
Yeah. It makes things more complex initially in the hopes of solving the later complexity. You're kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I think it's important to note for our listeners that, you know, it's not just the RNA world hypothesis. It's not as though there's some other great origin of life story out there that makes sense. The whole area of abiogenesis research is in a real theoretical crisis right now, I would say. We've gone down this path of trying simpler and simpler approaches since the late 1800s, really the 1600s, but let's say since Darwin's letter, as you mentioned, to Joseph Hooker, the end of the 1800s, 1872. We keep going down this path of let's do something simpler and simpler because it's recognized we can't depend on chance to produce the more complex functional structures that we see in biology. But now after decades and countless millions of dollars spent, we're finally coming around to realize that we can't just start with some simple system and make any meaningful progress. You need multiple things working together, and they have to be together, and they have to be in place at the same time in the same location and be coordinated. And from an engineering standpoint, I know you're an engineer as well. It hardly is a remarkable observation. It's almost something of a well-done moment. But it's a real problem for the unguided step-by-blind step of the abiogenesis creation story.
That is so absolutely true, Eric. And I think it's important if our audience takes away nothing else from this talk, people need to understand this basic truth that today there is no compelling scientific explanation for life. The origin of life field has not done the job, and we do not have a scientific explanation for it, despite the headlines you might read. And really, that's being kind. The anthropic barriers faced, the complexities faced, the difficulties are enormous. You could put origin of life on that list of phenomena in our world that science really doesn't touch. Science does not explain. It's important because we live in a world where so often we're sent these messages of the exact opposite. Science pretty much explains everything. We know it all pretty much. There's a few details to fill in, and that simply is not the case.
Yeah. Well, that's a great takeaway. Well, I sure appreciate you being with us today, and this is an excellent topic, one of my favorites. So I'm so happy that you were able to join us, Cornelius, to talk about the origin of life.
My pleasure, Eric.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. If you enjoy this podcast and learning more about these important issues, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, for ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.